if in my high moments I have done some good, offered some service, shed some light, healed some wounds, rekindled some hope, or stirred some warmth of apathy and indifference, or in any way along the way helped somebody, then this campaign has not been in vain.
With your host, Andrew Gordon. Keiko Mitsumatsu, how are you today? Welcome to the Yoga Moves You podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
It is a really, truly an honor and a privilege to have you on. You are the founder of Yoga Gives Back, which is an amazing organization, which is not a baby. It's been around. Before we get to that, and some of the great things that you have going on and that you've done and you're about to venture on to, I want to talk about something that you wrote and kind of conduct the interview from that perspective. So these are your words. The first half of my life was to learn from experiences. The second half of my life is to serve others as much as possible. Now, first of all, I love that perspective because we start out really as blank canvases and we are painting our canvases and also being painted on, and we learn. And then if we can, you know, Maya Angelou, if you learn, teach, if you get, give. And that's really what I get from that quotation, which is wonderful, in parallel to your words. I wanted to start with that and say, before we get to the second half of your life, which is service, I want to go back to the first half. And perhaps if we're talking basketball, the first quarter, if it were professional, not college, and we're talking like a basketball game. So where did you grow up?
Interesting. Okay. I was born in Tokyo in 1960. Post-World War II, like economic miracle growth was taking place. My father works for the bank, big bank in Japan, workaholic, just like any other fathers during that time.
Yeah.
And I stayed in Japan until I was 18. Then I went to Australia for a year as an exchange student. I lived in a local community in the 1978-79 New South Wales, just north of Sydney.
That's really cool. What made you want to do that?
That's a good question. I was born into this very conservative, you know, middle class family, but I really always was interested in like experiencing other cultures. And my parents also made me study English conversation ever since we were little. We had like American tutors coming to our home.
Yes.
So, like I was exposed to different cultures early on and I was very fascinated. And I think in many ways my parents are very education oriented. So they just encouraged me to do things like that. I was very fortunate in that sense.
I can only assume that your dad, having a good position with the bank, that he would know that English would play a role in business or with some sort of communications if you're looking to deal with people outside of your immediate area.
Yes, but also interestingly, that this is like post-war Japan. Japan lost World War II in 1945 and I was born 1960.
Yeah.
So I think Japan was still going through kind of inferior complex to the US, English speaking countries especially.
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate you talking about this because I haven't had anyone who I've ever been able to personally speak about this experience and going through it. I've had students from Japan. It's never come up. And to hear it firsthand from you is really, I respect you for speaking about it, and it really is interesting. So please go on.
Yeah, so I think it was a very different time than back then, you know. So, of course, learning English was something like of status. And of course, my parents, like you said, probably have thought I'll have more opportunities if I had English language in the future. I don't know how much seriously they thought about it, because also like in the household, my parents are very conservative, which I rebelled quite a bit later on. But I was a girl. I have a 2-year-old brother. We grew up in a very different way. I was always the one to help my mother in the kitchen and cleaning up and stuff like that. For my brother, education was the most important. So he never moved around in Japan with my father's job. I was always changing schools because I had to stay with my parents. So we grew up in a very different way, which kind of seeded in my mind very strongly the question, how come we are treated differently? We're just girl and boy, why we are different? So that kind of led me to work in my own way, Yoga Gives Back, some way to educate girls.
Yeah, it all starts with our childhood if we look back. And basically, if we break it down at a very simple macro level, we can get into details of everyone's own story. But from a macro level, I truly believe that what we lacked or what we truly desired and did not have as a child, we do what we can to accomplish that or to attain that as adults.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think it's very important to have that kind of question, even though you don't have answers as a child, but stick to this question, you know, because there are no answers at that moment because of the environment, but there are some other answers somewhere else in the world. I think that's what I found when I went out of Japan at the age of 18.
But before that, you must have been in Japan because you went to an all-girls school called, and again, my pronunciation, if I mess it up, excuse me, Gakushuin, girls. Yeah. It was an all-girls high school. So did that help you focus being that it was all girls, or was there too much of just the feminine energy in one building? Like, did you feel like, why am I in an all-girls school? Or, I don't know. I was never in one.
Yeah, this is a very, very conservative, traditional private girls' high school I went.
Okay.
And it was my choice because I, as I said, I had to change my schools so much. Every year I had to change my middle school. I had to change school every year, so which was very difficult for me.
Oh my gosh. Now, I know in America, that age specifically, okay, is a very tough one in general, but to move in as the new kid at that age is very tough. Is it, I mean, in its own way, does it, is it still similar like that in Japan?
Oh, definitely. You know, trying to find your comfort zone or, you know, trying to get acknowledged. Or, you know, like, you have to prove yourself each time, you know, when you step into a new school with a new school uniform. And especially coming from Tokyo, then we went to South, you know, Osaka area, which has very different language. So that was really actually very difficult for me, but it was a very good experience. I experienced that there are different cultures even within Japan, you know?
For sure, for sure. I mean, I think of America, and I realize America is, I guess, a pretty a big country as far as landscape goes. But, you know, regionally, you move around a country and it's like you could feel like you're in a different world depending on where you go. So even Japan, geographically, it's not as big as America. But yeah, of course. I mean, I can imagine going from where the big city is to just either the countryside or even another city is going to be a different just based on who lives there, where it's located, and what kind of business and industry happens there.
Yeah. So my middle school time, I saw in my final school, I saw like real bad bullying and things like that. So I really decided to go to this private girls' school to have like, I didn't want to be distracted by all these problems. You know,
I don't blame you.
Yeah, I was surrounded by it and I just kind of resorted to this girls' high school, and it was really great because I played volleyball for 3 years and I had opportunity.
That's cool.
Yeah, to study and have good friends who still remain my best friends.
Wow, that's so awesome. That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. You did have a good run there at the girls' school because you ended up going to university, which is Sophia University, which is still in Japan, and you chose to major in modern history and international relations. So I want to ask you, what made you want to focus on the modern history piece? And then more importantly, because I know what you do now, the international relations.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think there was something that maybe wasn't publicized that you don't know. After Australia, I actually went to Brazil and lived there 2 years.
Again,
my father's work. And so we lived in São Paulo, and that was another huge cultural shock.
That city's huge and busy. I know a lot of people live there.
Yeah. But also the poverty and the wealth, you know, in the third world or developing country, but the sheer poverty, like street children, like I've never seen these things in Japan or in Australia.
Yeah.
The first time I was exposed to real poverty and social issues like that. And then, so I decided to study international politics and modern history of Japan at Sophia University back in Japan.
So was that experience in Sao Paulo that made you, really was a true trigger to study this path of international relations? If you can recall going back to in your mind to Sao Paulo, seeing and being really culture shocked for the first time, seeing poverty and street kids, what was the feeling, if you could put it into a word or two or three, that jumps out in your mind?
Yeah, I think it just made me realize there is the whole world out there that I have no idea what it's like to be on that side of the world.
Okay. Yeah,
definitely. Because I also, you know, we had an employee person, you know, who was my age, 18 at that time, who was living with us, very dark-skinned woman. And I tried to explain how I love to swim. I didn't know the word swim is nadar in Portuguese. I didn't know that word. So I was like trying to tell her, you know, swimming, swimming. And I was doing with my motion, you know, like doing.
Yes.
She had no idea. And I just didn't understand why she doesn't understand. I'm showing how to swim. And I later on, I realized she never swam in her life. But these are the kind of things, like, I just realized I don't know anything about that side of the world.
Yeah.
It just blew my mind. And then you still living in that city, I see them every day, and they make jokes. You know, like, Brazilians are so good at making jokes. So these are poorest people making jokes and make us laugh, like, so crazy. Like, it's not just sadness. That's another thing. It's, I just learned that there's life there, and there's laughter, too. Of course, there is misery too, but, you know, now we know that misery is in the wealthiest people too. So at that time, I didn't conceptualize like that, but I just knew that there was four totally different lifestyle and values and everything else out there. That's one thing I really learned.
You're talking about Brazil, but I can tell you, you know, firsthand in New York, how different all the neighborhoods are, but where the cultures really form music and slang. Yeah. And all these things that become sometimes international phenomena from the poorest neighborhoods. Because really, if you don't have the typical paths to go to college or to go to whatever the standard is, and you don't have a lot of means, you have to be creative. And when, you know, for me, I use an example, okay? So you go to the subway and you see a kid banging on a bucket, and he's brilliant as a drummer. Now this kid could be the next brilliant drummer with a drum kit, you know, playing in a band, but he's doing it in a subway. And that's simply because of resources or lack of resources, but there's something beautiful about it at the same time.
You have to be exposed to that kind of experience to realize and to not to have preconception to judge, you know? So I think that's very important to be exposed.
I used to tell my students, and then I'll get off myself because it's not about me, it's about you, but you're making me think for a moment. When I taught in the Bronx, I was in a very challenging neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I would tell the students, which were middle school age, I was teaching them English and they spoke Spanish. They were mostly Dominican. Mm-hmm. But I said, at one point, I had a conversation with them. I said, you all are so street smart. You have no idea. Like, you just don't even understand that the fact that you make it here every day and that you survive and that you have to do so many adult things and that you are so far advanced with your wit, with your jokes. You make me laugh even when I try not to laugh, but you make me laugh and I'm your teacher and I have to hide it. But, you know, you do because you're smart. In order to be funny, you need to be smart. So I said, so I just want you to think for a second. If you could take your street smarts, which I'm telling you that I know you have, and combine them with your book smarts, if you could just focus on that a little bit and balance the two, oh my gosh, you will be so powerful. Mm. You know, and I gave them an example of a couple of people. You know, I think at that time, I think I used Jay-Z and Barack Obama to, if I bring up an example, someone's going to criticize me, be like, oh, why'd you pick that person? So I try, but I know that's who I use for the people at that time in the class. But the point is, I think, or I hope, that it resonated with them, that it meant something to them, because I did believe what I said. You know? So anyway, you graduated from college and then you went out to work. So you went and you worked for NHK, the Japan Broadcasting Corporation, and you spent a good amount of time there, almost a decade. You ended up being the producer and director for the company, but I don't assume that you started in that position. I got two questions. How did you work your way up? Like, what was your first position there? How did you get in? And then what was the progress climbing your way through the ladder there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because NHK, I went in there in 1984, and they take college graduates either as, they used to take us as a director, producer, journalist, like reporter, or administration person.
Yeah.
Or anchor person. There were these four job categories from the beginning.
Wow, that's interesting.
So I just applied for producer director because I really love documentaries as I grew up. And the only thing I said during these interviews to get into NHK was like, I wanted to make a documentary about carnival in Rio, how the poorest people in town dress up and put everything they have into that carnival.
Sure.
Fascinated about that. Then I got the job. So we just got the training on the job.
Oh my gosh. That's so fascinating. There's no such thing as an internship. You don't have to like send out faxes and like cut the paper up.
It was all in one. You know, it's very interesting the way how they still work because I worked there for them like 30 years in total. So the producers, director do everything. I collected their monthly payments as a training, going one by one from house to house with a stamp and paper receipts. You know, these are the training we had.
Oh, so you were like an intern at one point. Okay, I get you.
Like 2 months. But then after 2 months, we were put into programs, TV programs, radio programs, and we just had to learn from scratch with senior producers and directors. But one thing I want to really actually underscore here is when I went in there, 1984, Japan still hadn't signed equal opportunity law. So there were only 3 of us among 48 of producer directors who entered that year.
Yeah.
Because the company had a 10% cap for women employees at that time. So we were only 3 of us. And also at that time, I had a time code every week that capped. No matter how many hours I had overworked, I had a cap. I could only put maximum, like I forgot how many hours. It took another 3 years until Japan signed the, you know, equal opportunity law that we had the same male colleagues and I had the same time card. Can you believe it?
Well, I mean, I love that you're giving me an education, and I'm going to have to assume a percentage of our listeners, you're giving an education on the law of equal opportunity in Japan. I did not know that. And that's really a great piece of information to share. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it changed while you were working. So did you see the changes that were implemented take place as meaningful, or it took a while for them to really be implemented truly by the companies?
Yeah, it took a long time, and I'm not sure if it's completely in a practical or more like
100%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay,
we could charge as much work as we did equally, but I don't know, you know. And also, like later on, maybe after I left, I could see like more women were employed and more women directors are taking maternity leave, and some men started to take in maternity leave. So the culture definitely has changed last 10 to 20 years after I left.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Just the two things you mentioned are amazing. So what I really, and I'm glad you brought all that up, and I had a question prepared to ask you about your time there. If you could think of the project that you're most proud of, because you did spend a good amount of time there, so when that comes to mind.
I did documentaries. Many documentaries of different minority groups, children with disability or aging population or labor issues. I just try to do as much as possible to give a chance for voiceless.
Yeah, you used the word I was going to bring up. And I think, do you feel as though you use your position with broadcasting, because when you work in broadcasting, just like here, you know, podcasts, you know, mm-hmm. of course, if you're on a major platform like the NHK, mm-hmm. Japan Broadcasting Corporation, that you chose to use your voice for the voiceless, because going way back to when you felt that you and your brother were treated differently, like that's what sparked this whole thing. Like, hey, you know what? This is like everyone should be equal.
Definitely, definitely. And then my experience in Brazil, when I saw the social injustice for the poor population, and you know, all my previous experiences were deeply rooted in my consciousness that I chose topics that I wanted to make documentaries about. I propose these kind of stories always.
That is commendable. Mm-hmm. And I can totally get your intrinsic motivation for that. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in between your time with NHK, you worked with the Embassy of Japan in London. Yep. And you promoted the Japan Festival. And mm-hmm. you were also part of the G7 Summit.
Yeah.
What's it like being part of the G7 Summit? Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, I'm impressed how much you studied about my bio.
Well, thank you.
So I was hired by a foreign ministry in Japan while I was in NHK because I could speak some English and some people recommended me to be culture attaché. Yeah. So I was hired. And so I was like a culture attaché plus press person because I had, you know, been working for NHK. So I know what, you know, press wants to do. So interesting thing is like I learned how journalists actually collect English language materials, like foreign ministers' speeches and all these things from foreign office.
Yeah.
I don't know how much I can talk about these things.
I'd rather not get anyone in trouble. So if we're dancing in an area that is not comfortable, we can certainly dance back out of it.
Yeah. But, you know, the interesting thing was like I worked with the government and I learned how they deal with publicity or the Japan's image, all these kind of things with media. So I have learned, I was working from the other side first and then I came to the government side. So I learned both sides. That was very interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating because I think there's oftentimes that many people, and it goes both ways. So you have, at least here in America, because I'm more familiar with it, where people worked in the media and then they mm-hmm. enter into politics. Not even if they're like a face of the politics, but they're doing something like mm-hmm. behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Or they worked in politics and they end up speaking about politics in the media. And it's like the two kind of weave and hang out with each other because they're both powerful and they're both influential and they both need each other.
Yeah. Well, if you look at this administration, you can tell how, you know, media plays a huge role in politics.
Yeah.
And I think many countries the same.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, look, I worked in media myself, so I feel like I can speak on it somewhat. I'll just say that we are best to think about having the ability to program ourselves. And I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
So you went on to become the founder and president of Yoga Gives Back. Now, I know your path. I know your heart. I know that you have compassion. I know your intrinsic values of giving a voice to the voiceless, which is awesome. How in the world do you form this organization, Yoga mm-hmm. Gives Back? Because it's not like you can just pop up, especially a nonprofit. You can't just pop it up and make it appear out of a hat like a rabbit, like a magician. So what's the process of that like?
Yeah, thank you for asking.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there are a lot of very important elements, which are explicit and which are implicit. I founded this organization 11 years ago. It was 2007.
Yeah.
So I was still working as an independent producer, coordinator, researcher, director for NHK. And we were producing a documentary about social entrepreneurship. And so we were spending a lot of time at Stanford University and UC Berkeley, Silicon Valley area. And then we studied about microfinancing because Dr. Muhammad Yunus just won Nobel Peace Prize from Bangladesh with his very successful microfinancing.
Can you, without really going into full economic lesson, can you just give to the average person like myself what microfinancing is in its mm-hmm. most basic form?
Yeah. So the poor person who doesn't have car or house or anything, doesn't have, you know, traditional banks term collateral. So yes. they don't get any, they can't get any loan or credit card or anything, right? Especially yes. in the developing countries.
Yeah.
That's why poor people usually have to get some loans from, you know, middleman or shark person.
No, we call them loan sharks.
Loan sharks.
That's a phrase here. So,
to get some money so that they can survive and do some business. But as a result of that, they usually don't have enough profit to accumulate to get out of poverty. They're spending all the interest, you know, all the profit for to pay back the loan sharks' interest and so on. So they were. The system is, traditional system seems to be made to make sure that poor people stay poor, you know, like,
it's
right.
Yeah. I mean, look, you can go back to, and I really don't bring religion into the podcast because really yoga to me, we're inviting anyone who either doesn't have a religion or has a religion. I don't care. I can just reference the Bible. It talks a lot in the Proverbs about, you know, the debtor. Mm-hmm. And the guarantor, you know, like you become a slave when you're in debt. So it warns you about that, to avoid that. But really, then what choice do you have if this, I can tell you personally here in America, you know, the best rate loan that would actually be fair, right, from instead of a loan shark would be outside of what you're talking about. This is why I asked you about it, outside of microfinancing, would be to try and get a small business loan from the Small mm-hmm. Business Association, from the government. And it's one of those things where it's like, you can't get it unless you already have money.
Right. So it's a vicious circle. So that's why Dr. Muhammad Yunus, and there were some other people in the world around, especially in the 70s, some people studied it. Dr. Yunus studied this microfinancing, realizing he was a professor of, you know, macroeconomics, you know, teaching big economics, but he realized so many people dying of hunger because of the famine in Bangladesh in the 70s. So he realized, why don't I give some small money to the poorest people? So I think he gave like $30 or $40 for the group of like 10 women so that they can buy their bamboos from the source, not going through the middleman, but go to the source and get the bamboo, and they make their bamboo stools, then sell in the market. So that whatever they sold, profit is theirs, you know?
That's brilliant. Again, on a micro level, you know what I mean? Like, it's just so smart.
Exactly. So that's how, long story short, within like 30 years, so he received Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. In 30 or 40 years, he proved that this was a big success in helping millions of people in Bangladesh and all over the world. So I was interviewing actually Kiva.org, who actually replicated Dr. Yunus's microfinancing on the website. You know, it's a very brilliant idea. We did a documentary and they were raising $1 million. Today they are raising over $1 billion to alleviate poverty with, you know, very small money. So if you give $25 to some person, he can use that money for in the developing countries. You know, $25 in India goes a long way.
Yes.
And they can start a business of like maybe buy a sewing machine or rent a sewing machine, start from scratch, but their own business, right?
Yes.
So I was fascinated about this idea, just going back to how I started yoga.
Yeah. I mean, because it's amazing. You know, it's a story to share before we even get to the what you're actually doing. I just want to hear how it became.
Yeah, so I was fascinated with this microfinancing power. And then I came back. So I was filming in Washington, D.C. or Seattle, you know, following these stories. And then I come back to Los Angeles and I started just taking Ashtanga yoga class around that time.
Okay.
And something happened inside me. Like I was just sweating a lot.
Of course.
So happy. I am very... I like exercise anyway, so I started as an exercise, but very soon my teacher started teaching me like Sanskrit and introduced me to Indian philosophical books.
Yeah.
Actually, that's when I learned about that first part of your life is to experience, second part is to give. You know, that wasn't my original words. I learned from some Indian philosophical books. So anyways, something happened within myself that made me realize I was 47 at that time. I was so happy.
Yes.
And I'm like, how much more happiness and health can I take to myself? You know, my great job. I was overworking, but I was very happy with all my work, yes. You know, documentary making. And I have this time to do yoga when I come home. So when I read that first part of your life is to experience, second part is to give, serve to others, that really hit me to my core. Because when I look back my 47 years of my life, no matter how I looked at it, I was very blessed with so many opportunities, so many learning experiences.
Yeah.
And I was ready, really ready to do some. I didn't, you know, I'm married, but I didn't have my own children to look after. Or at that time, my parents were not old enough to be looked after. So I was kind of independent. Sure. I was ready to do something. So then I just thought that I was taking some donation classes at my yoga studio. There were some cancer benefits. HIV was very big at that time.
Yeah.
One day I realized, you know, India has so much poverty. 75% of the population still live under $2 a day. Yeah. But there was nothing, no charity class that was focusing on helping or giving back to the source of yoga that we were enjoying so much and benefiting so much from.
Oh my God. Yeah. You have to listen to the interview I did with the people that work as a branch of Holy Yoga.
Okay.
And when I talked to them about, you know, India being the root, mm-hmm. and how they responded to that and just saying, well, we don't know if it came from it. And I'm like, stop, just stop. Mm-hmm. Don't speak anymore because you're really going to dig yourself a deep hole. Contrast that to you on the flip side. Mm-hmm. Who's the truth, who's acknowledging it, saying this gift originated from this place. Let's help these people instead of taking it and bastardizing it, which I love. Mm-hmm. I love it. And talking about wealth does not make us good or bad. Wealth magnifies who we are. So in your case, wealth or money magnified your ability to be this person who wants to give the voice to the voiceless.
Yeah. And then wealth is... You know, we are not talking about wealth in millions of dollars.
No.
That's another thing. So very soon, I just wanted to share, like, very soon we decided our mantra is, for the cost of one yoga class, you can change your life.
Yeah.
So it cost of yoga class at that time was $15. Maybe today is 20 to 25. But you're paying that anyways, and I'm not asking you to run suddenly 5K. If you're doing yoga anyways and you're benefiting from it, just give one class a year. That's all we ask. And so that's how we started. And long story short, but I started telling this story to my teacher first, and he loved the idea. And we talked to our yoga studio owner, and I guess everybody was just ready to jump in, because in 10 years, we are now in 20 countries.
Unbelievable.
We are now funding over 1,100 mothers and children with microloans and education funds. And we are committed to give every person minimum 5 years of assistance so they have a chance to transform. It is a sustainable model that we don't just leave a chunk of money and leave.
Yeah.
We want to grow together with them. So I go back to India almost every year and film different stories. I follow up some people so that people can really see what your donation is doing to their lives. These are very important things. And then my professional career as a documentary filmmaker became handy, because when we don't have much money to run, I can just film and come back and edit, which takes time, but you know, I don't have to hire many professional people.
Hey, that's what me and the podcast do.
Like you, right?
Yeah, you know, like, it's your skill set. And I don't have to outsource this. In fact, I do it for other people. But again, jumping back to your cause and the grassroots of this whole thing and how it evolved organically, if you're listening to this, and I'm speaking to our listeners across the world, and you practice yoga, or you even talk about yoga or know somebody who practices yoga, to hear Kayoka's story and how authentic it is and how she created this, to not even think about donating what it costs for one yoga class for what she's doing, which is giving back to where the root of this amazing thing that, you know, changed your life, because I know I talk to many people who listen, including the guests that are on, but including me myself, right? Mm-hmm. It changed my life, which is why I have the podcast and, you know, this gift. Like, she put this all together. So to blow this off as something that's just another charity is a huge disservice to yourself and to yoga. I really, really want to stand firm as someone that has a big mouth, and I want to put my big mouth into Yoga Gives Back because there's truth tied to this story. And I think that's what really holds a lot of weight in my mind with me. She has done the work and she has the proof. And I think the impact that it has on where this gift of yoga came from that we use, she gives back and helps these people and helps these impoverished areas, you know, whether they're flourishing or not, she's giving back and she's trying. And I think that is so commendable. And to not join on to that, to not feel like that's a cause that you should give to, I really think you need to question yourself if you practice yoga and you can't give the price of one of your classes to this organization.
Thank you. And I just want to add, it's not just me. I started this, but now we have over 100 ambassadors who are yoga teachers or yoga studio owners and volunteers, over 200 maybe all over the world, who are supporting fundraising classes and raising funds from all over the world. So we just did a first Seva trip with 7 ambassadors from all over the world. We went all our programs in India because I really want people who has been trusting me and trusting the organization and donating to really see the impact of their effort and support with their own eyes. And so I just want to emphasize how so many people are supporting this. And that's how we are now launched 1 Million Yogis campaign, where we know that 300 million people practice yoga today in the world, $80 billion. If that's true, 1 Million Yogis campaign is like a very small fraction of the whole yoga population. If everybody of 1 Million Yogis give us $1, or if you don't have money, you just volunteer.
Yes.
You know? Things like that adds up, and we can help so many people.
And I just want to go back to the point that your organization, Yoga Gives Back, has been around for 11 years. So it's not like it just started up, okay? There's nothing really to look at the organization and say, where's the money going? Is it questionable? You can't. You can't question it. There is no case for that. It's held its own, and it's grown, and it's proven what it's done. I support it, and I hope you do as well. And I want to move on to talk about the 1 Million Yogis campaign. So can you elaborate on that for our audience, please?
Yes, thank you. Yes, so as I said, if there is, you know, 300 million yogis in the world, our campaign is all about grassroots campaign. Like Bernie Sanders used to say, his voters donated average of $24-$27, and he raised millions of dollars.
Yeah,
right. That's kind of where we want to go. We don't have to even go average 27, average 5, average $1 is fine, but people have to take actions. You know, that's one thing I really want to spread word, and with your help and everybody who's listening, you have to take action. You know, it's one thing to hear my story or hear other story and say, wow, that's great, but take action and be part of it. I think that's when things change within you. I've seen many teachers or many volunteers who take part and do some work or donate and follow the stories or, you know, get involved. That's when I think things change within you. And some people say, you know, this is seva, you know, service to the others. And that's the ultimate goal of yoga. I didn't know any of this when I started this. And I still kind of sometimes hesitate to use too much yoga words because I'm not a Sanskrit or yoga scholar. But I think there's something very special in yoga practice. As you, Andrew, and many listeners know, it's not just physical practice.
Oh, no.
Then you start, I started as like exercise, losing some weight or something like that. But
yeah,
once you start continuous regular practice, and also, you know, you're exposed to this philosophy of yoga, then you realize it's not just hitting balls or kicking balls. It's much, much deeper. Physical exercise is just a very small part of it. And then you are open to like this humongous tradition and philosophy, which is so beautiful. And the community, I am so grateful for everybody who gets involved in Yoga Gives Back work from all over the world. They are like my brothers and sisters now.
That's so beautiful. I think that whether your intention is to learn about the other limbs of yoga and the philosophical components or not, if you're one of the people who come into it, which is very common on the physical side, it's going to catch you. It's going to get you. Because if you stay consistent, you'll find that these little nuances in your life where you used to get upset at certain things, or you're more compassionate and you're more loving, you're more peaceful, you care, you want to serve. These things happen without even thinking because you just practice, you stay true to it, and you show up. It's amazing. And I don't know how to explain it other than you have to be somewhat consistent. Like maybe you don't have to practice 7 times a week, but you know, a good amount over a period of time with the physical asana practice, I promise you the rest of it will all find its way to you. And I don't know how else to explain it better. I wish I could be more eloquent, but I'll say it will show up in your life.
Yeah. I think maybe your listeners already know it.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. You know, for people like you to come on, it's a testament to what we've built with the podcast in just 4 months. And I say that really not to brush dirt off my shoulder and pop my own collar. It's not about me. It's not about me. Mm-hmm. It's about me having a passion and you know, to reach out and to talk about these other avenues of yoga that are missed out within the yoga industry. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So the yoga industry is a beautiful thing. You know, capitalism is great. Making money is great. There's nothing wrong with that. Nobody tells you not to do that. But how about giving back? You know, especially in this case, giving back to the root of where it came from. My gosh, these people are impoverished. And the women in some certain areas of India, in certain situations, you can research and see some things online. It's horrendous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to take even a small part in helping with that, where this gift of yoga originated from, is something that you could feel proud of.
Yeah, definitely.
So I really want to thank you, Kyoko, for coming on to the Yoga Moves You podcast. Is there anything else that you would like to add in terms of Yoga Gives Back? I know you have the 1 Million Yogis campaign. Where can people find you? And of course, you know, I will stay after the interview with your email back to make sure all of the show notes are in proper order and people can connect and research and find you the best ways possible.
Yeah, thank you so much. So we are now launching Extra Push, Pushed campaign to engage more people for 1 Million Yogis campaign during the month of June, because June 21st is now International Yoga Day. You all know, probably United Nations proclaimed that, but we decided the whole month of June. Why don't you join this 1 Million Yogis campaign? You do your class anyway, so donate from your class, or just donate or do something, and think about the people of India today who don't have any luxury to do yoga. So let's give back. Don't just take it to ourselves only.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, my birthday is June 26th. So think of me during the month of June as well. And donate, not because of me, but donate because of everything that Kyoko has built, all the ambassadors and all the people that help with it.
Yeah.
My gosh, yoga gives back. Kyoko Mitsumasu, your story has been interesting to listen to. What a phenomenal journey that you have blazed and path that you have walked, and the mindfulness and the actions that you've taken to contribute to make this world a better place, specifically the world that impacted you, which is yoga, when you kind of stumbled into it and then realized, wow, this is great. Where does it come from? Okay, well, what's going on over there? These people need our help. I'm so proud to have you on the show. Just thank you for your time. And we're going to help in any way we can.
Thank you so much, Andrew. And thanks, everyone.